I mean, in the abstract, you could have like kids come and then the teachers beam in remotely. I don't know how you would do that or something, right?
Nate's never met a child, you guys.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. In case there was any doubt, the United States is again facing a COVID-19 crisis. After more than 2 months of decline, COVID-19-related deaths are on the rise again. Data from the New York Times currently shows about 60,000 new cases per day and deaths around 700 per day. The question now is, what is the United States going to do about it? What do Americans want? What do politicians support? And are those two things the same? So we're going to dig into that today. We're also going to interrogate some post-2016 wisdom in the Democratic Party. After Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016, some Democrats concluded that she spent too much time talking about quote-unquote identity politics. Today, Biden is spending a lot of time talking about race and issues facing minorities, and he seems to be doing just fine. So what's different 4 years later? Here with me to discuss are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Hi, Galen.
And I also wanted to mention before we get going that Perry is going to be joining us full time on Mondays. I hope, listeners, you've appreciated his analysis and reporting these past few weeks as much as we have. So we're excited to have him to help cover the 2020 election as things heat up. So officially welcome, Perry.
Thank you, Galen. I appreciate that.
And Micah is busy as ever as managing editor at 538. You certainly haven't heard the last from him. He will be joining us from time to time on this podcast. So let's talk about the increase in coronavirus cases and now deaths. So on top of that, concerns about the virus among Americans are back to all-time highs, or even above where they were in the spring in some cases. So let's start off with this broad question, and then we can narrow in on some details. So Nate, kick us off. What do Americans want to do about this crisis at this moment in time? And what are politicians willing to do to kind of stem the virus, given where we are now?
You know, I think Americans just want it to go away and have no idea how to make it go away. I mean, look, I think this is a very difficult problem. In polls, people mostly say that we're reopening too fast instead of too slowly. That has been fairly consistent over the months. People started changing their opinion a bit when cases were going down, and now people are being more cautious again when you ask that question, and their kind of concerns about coronavirus are on the rise again. I think there's some question here of how well people's prescriptions for what politicians should do or how other people should behave matches up with their own behavior. People are wearing masks more, but social distancing less. And you see that both when you kind of ask people like, hey, were you socially distancing this week, or did you go see friends and family? As of last month, for example, a majority of Americans were saying we do see friends and family now occasionally. If you look at data that tracks people's movement from Apple, we saw big upticks in movement over the course of the spring that may be abating now as people are being more careful, especially in the South and the Southwest where you have a lot of issues right now. But like, look, I think the fundamental problem is that lockdowns and social distancing were not a solution that anyone intended to persist for more than, let's call it, 2 to 3 months. The idea was supposed to be that we do lockdowns and social distancing and it sucks, but while we're doing that, we set up a better testing and tracing infrastructure, we learn more about the virus, right? And we kind of create a sustainable medium-term future where it's possible to get somewhat back to normal until the long run where you get a vaccine or treatments that really kind of make it more easy to have like a real version of normal. The United States as a whole did not really do that. So what I'm saying is like, this is a pretty difficult problem. You have either a lot of COVID spreading, or a lot of distancing, which people get fatigued by, or you have to have other really sophisticated solutions that, frankly, America might not be up to the task to with the current leadership that we have in charge. So you're kind of screwed either way.
Nate said that there's increasing support for being careful, more social distancing, skepticism about reopening too early. How does that interact with the appetite among politicians to institute and enforce restrictions and be pretty careful as we move forward in this pandemic?
The science of coronavirus is becoming a little bit more clear to us, but also the pressing problems are becoming more complicated. I think solving the big problems, the really, really, really sticky problems of schools and childcare, have made politicians wade into a debate that's already very, I think, scientifically murky, from people's personal risk assessment, very murky. And Trump and DeVos and a number of other Republican politicians weighed in this kind of partisan way, saying, you got to open the schools back up in the fall. Trump went so far as to say, we're going to withhold federal funding for some schools if you don't reopen. So I think the really complicated thing is that we've layered on politics to a situation. And I think the biggest crisis right now facing America is what to do about reopening schools, what to do about the childcare crisis, which redounds to the economy, particularly to women who are primary caretakers of children often. We are seeing that really complicated problem be politicized in this way that I think makes some of the public health best practices, particularly in states like Florida and Texas that are, you know, experiencing this problem in the crisis way that, let's say, the Northeast experienced in the early spring, that really makes politicians' public comments quite weighty. And I think in some ways this is the worst kind of debate for politicians to weigh in on, in part because through no fault of their own, right, through the dint of their training, they're largely not doctors or public health professionals, and therefore cannot give the kind of straightforward talk that I think a lot of people want. But also there are absolutely no clear answers on this, which is not something that, like, our partisan mindset bends well to.
So even just focusing on public opinion and what Americans think about reopening schools, I dug up some polling on this. And if you look nationally, in general, majority of Americans worry about a rush to reopen schools. On the state level, I saw 65% of Texans say that it's unsafe to send their kids to school right now. Californians, a majority favor a partial reopening or no reopening over a full reopening. Then it also seems like location matters a little bit in the sense that a majority of Michiganders do feel at least somewhat comfortable sending their kids back to school. And there's a pretty significant partisan split there. So why, when the majority of Americans and in some of these states that are experiencing outbreaks right now, there's a lot of skepticism of sending kids back to school, are people like Trump, DeVos, and DeSantis making these blanket statements like send everybody back to school or, you know, funding might be withheld? What's going on there?
I think the short answer is Trump's view of this is, I want to bring America sort of back to normal as soon as possible. And one view of that, I think the correct view of that might be, you need to reduce the virus spread first. And that's the key to that. He seems to think if we get everybody back to work and get everybody back to school, that will make America normal. And I think it will reduce the unemployment rate. That's true. It will make it easier for some parents. That's true. It also might result in a further spread of the coronavirus, and therefore it would not make America back to normal. I think he has a strategy that is both focused on probably electoral, in the sense that he wants the unemployment rate to go down. He thinks that'll do that. It's probably a little bit ideological as well. I don't think the public school teachers are nervous about going back to school. Betsy DeVos does not like the public school teachers when what they think about much of anything, so I'm not surprised she disagrees with them. But I do think it's worth isolating on, I think if you asked most Americans, should schools open, they would ask questions, logical questions like, where? If this city has no coronavirus, then sure. If they would ask where, how, should older teachers be exempted? Should younger teachers go more? Should we pay certain people more? Should we make sure the lunch ladies don't go if they're over 70? I think this is a complicated issue, and I think most Americans, the people I talk to in the polls, suggest some amount of nuance here. And the problem I don't think think is even Republican voters in the polls suggest some nuance in their views. And I would just isolate it. Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Donald Trump, and Betsy DeVos are not speaking in any nuance at all. I don't think it's politicians. I think it's a few politicians of a lot of power who are speaking in very unnuanced ways and shaping this debate in a way. I don't think you're meeting a lot of Democratic governors who are saying, close every school ever. The extremism, I would say, is on one side.
Yeah. And I think what's hard about the question of schools, which is inextricably linked with childcare, both at home and childcare centers. First of all, there's lots of stakeholders. There's parents, there's teachers, there's politicians, there's the business community, all of whom have a stake in children going back to school, but also have concerns. The other big thing about schools going back, reopening, even in places that don't have big outbreaks, is will teachers and students have the proper PPE? That actually costs quite a bit of money. You're going to also need to potentially give people childcare supplements. If, let's say, you have a first grader and they're going to school two times a week in school, but you've got to, you know, supervise them for those other 3 days a week, who's doing that? Are you sending them to daycare, which you wouldn't usually do because they'd be in, say, public school? Is one of the parents taking a step back from work? There's lots of really complicated problems here. The fall is going to be, no matter what happens, a hot mess. And I think politicians don't want to acknowledge, or let's say Trump doesn't want to acknowledge that in some way, because he does want the idea of, okay, we have maybe some idea that younger children are perhaps less susceptible. You know, I've seen a lot of arguments from, frankly, like left-leaning academics who have said, yeah, you know what, we should push to have elementary school age children go back to school first. They seem to be less of a vector, perhaps. And also we have to be concerned for, yes, parents, the economy, parents being able to work. Again, women being able to work. In normal times, women do twice as much childcare in a day as men do. So imagine kids being, and that's Bureau of Labor Statistics data. That's not me spitballing. So imagine, you know, people who have been at home with their children trying to work, trying to do, you know, take care of their younger elementary school age children. This burden is falling on women. Women are like 47% of the American workforce. This is going to have a huge effect on the economy. This is not just a woman or families with kids problem. This is an American economic problem that is massive.
I mean, yeah. So first of all, there is evidence that getting COVID is much less likely to kill you or cause severe harm if you're a child. Like, much less likely. Doesn't mean it never happens, but like, it's a pretty dramatic shift. And that's fortunate because not all epidemics are like that. In fact, there are many epidemics where you have a U-shaped curve where it's really bad in children and in old people. You know, if you try to actually quantify what are the long-term consequences of having a disrupted, let's call it 6 months worth of education, because districts can reassess in the spring, they're pretty severe. And they also perpetuate inequities because distance learning doesn't work as well if you don't have a reliable internet connection or a computer at all in your home. So the question is, how much are teachers and people that work at the school staff going to be affected by this, right? You know, that's hard to know. I mean, in the abstract, you could have like kids come and then the teachers beam in remotely. I don't know how you'd do that or something, right?
Nate's never met a child, you guys.
Well, you could have some, I don't know.
Nate was born like this. Nate was never a child himself.
I'm just saying, but it is like the point y'all were raising that like this is a conversation that requires some subtlety and some honesty about trade-offs, right? It's saying some additional number of people will get sick as a result of this, some of whom are teachers, but that's not as bad as having all our children missing half a year of education. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to make that assessment, but like, that's a conversation that the country probably needs to have. And when Trump comes in, that makes it very hard to have that needed conversation.
So part of this conversation about weighing risks, but then also being entrepreneurial in how you go about educating children and trying to alleviate the burden that parents have been feeling for months at this point, comes down to politicians, Congress, appropriating funds, the next relief bill. And I want to talk about the politics of that.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
So part of addressing this stage of the virus where cases are growing again, and at the same time, we're thinking about whether or not to send kids back to school and how, also coincides with a time when a lot of the relief that Congress passed in the spring is running out. Those increased unemployment benefits of $600 per week, the Paycheck Protection Program was never meant to last well past the summer. And so now it's up to Congress to figure out what to do. And on top of that, Congress takes usually a recess in August, so it has about 2 weeks to try to solve this problem at this point. Perry, what are the conversations like on Capitol Hill? What are the current dynamics?
One of the big problems is there's not a lot of conversation happening right now. You know, the Democrats passed the bill, I've forgotten when, probably about 6 weeks ago. They kind of had a lot of like aid to states, more money for testing. And it was a very big, expansive, I think a several trillion dollars bill. There was a sort of another COVID relief bill. The Republicans have said they've been pretty opposed to any kind of state aid until recently. They want to have a much smaller bill, $1 trillion at maximum. And so part of the divide here in this a big divide right now, and this reason there's no conversation, is it because Republicans and Trump generally believe that bigger aid bills, bigger relief bills will have more people staying on unemployment, not working, maybe more kids not going to school, because if states get more aid, maybe they'll decide differently in terms of school policy, in terms of employees. So the Republican view is generally if we give more support to sort of alleviate coronavirus, that'll stop the efforts to bring things back to normal. And the Republicans and Trump want to get people back to normal in terms of their jobs and in terms of their schools. Now, that was the debate as of like 2 weeks ago, probably. The one thing has shifted is as Arizona and Texas and Florida have these new spreads, it looks like it's going to be untenable to sort of say we're going back to normal. So I do think some kind of legislation is going to pass now that is going to have more unemployment benefits, more state aid. So the question is now less about do the parties disagree? The Republicans are coming to the Democratic position. The question will be how far do they move in that direction? Like my guess is they will pass some kind of unemployment benefits that are not as generous as the ones before, but are still not the sort of system we had in January.
It's something like a 1 or 2 time lump sum payment. Plus, I believe there was some discussion about, per Perry's point, of their concern that people are just going to stay on the unemployment rolls. They'll give you like a bonus if you re-enter the workforce. So you'd get a sum if you find a job. But it is a complicated thing that probably needs to happen sooner rather than later. I believe tied up in that extension of the relief is certain Republican senators have also been calling for, you know, giving more money to schools in order to shore up the PPE. So it's PPP for PPE. I don't know. That's not actually true. But like the relief package should include, you know, like greater safety measures for schools. But there are also bills that have not gotten a lot of public attention that I think will potentially, they could have big impact, you know, if they're not implemented over the next year or two. One of which is it's a Democratic-backed bill. I believe it was sponsored by Patty Murray about bailing out the childcare industry, something like $50 billion in order to shore up these largely small businesses, which operate on really small margins. And obviously people don't want to send their kids to daycare right now because your kid got a fever from daycare in normal times. You know, you're scared of sending them back to childcare during that time. And some of those places have stayed open during the pandemic to take care of the kids of essential workers. So they are doing work during this time. But there's lots of industries that we haven't been paying attention to and that we are just now starting to pay attention to, particularly as we take into consideration the schools problem. And frankly, some of the childcare discussions have to do with okay, you know, you don't send your kid to daycare, you send them to grandma. Maybe we should be paying grandma some money too, right? So there's also these, how do we compensate in this new makeshift economy that we're embarking on for the fall? Like, how do we make sure that people aren't, who are already on the margins, aren't falling off into the deep end?
Usually the wisdom seems that if you're the incumbent president, a bunch of stimulus spending could only benefit you if you're trying to win re-election. I mean, I think it seems like Democrats are on board. Where is this resistance coming from?
Pure ideological, you know, priors, I think, right? Because, yeah, you would want to put money in people's hands. It's one reason why initially people were like, actually, I still approve of Trump's performance in the economy, is because the economy was made more robust by the fact that you had a fairly generous stimulus package. I mean, it's just purely electorally idiotic. If there are issues with, maybe you create perverse incentives, okay, we've had a lot of time, now you can have some smart staffers draw up better incentives to avoid that, right? We're not rushing this legislation anymore, exactly. Yeah, there's no 13-dimensional chess. It's just idiotic in terms of electorally for getting GOP members reelected. I mean, the question is, you know, should Democrats kind of play hardball because they don't want to help Trump and the GOP? That's a more interesting question, I think, politically, because they might kind of go against what they stand for. But I don't think it makes a lot of sense.
Then let's ask that question. What do Democrats want out of all of this?
I think they want a bigger stimulus bill because they're trying to solve the problem, I think, to some extent. I mean, I don't think the Democrats need this bill to help them politically in some ways because they're doing fine. They don't need, like, in general, passing a bill that would alleviate a crisis but help the incumbent would be worrisome. If it was a two-point race, I think you would have some behind-the-scenes discussion about, are Democrats saving Trump by doing this bill? It would be behind the scenes because the bill would help people, so you couldn't talk about that in public. But I think at this point where Trump is down 10 points, I don't think Democrats are that nervous that passing a bill will help him that much because they're sure he'll pardon someone or do something else weird in the next hour and bring himself back down.
Do we think it's odd that there's been this reversion to, I mean, typically when we're talking about Trump's Republican Party, we're talking about how Trumpy it is, how different from the conventional Republican Party it is. So do we find it, like, interesting at all that there is this reversion to more typical fiscal conservative instincts in this crisis rather than we need to inject some emergency cash into the economy?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, this might be the kind of issue where Trump would be like, you know, screw you, Mitch McConnell, right? Our economy is needs a lot of help right now, right? We need to protect people. We need to get back to normal. Deficit spending, it's not very expensive to borrow right now, right? So, yeah, I mean, this is kind of, you know, unorthodox or heterodox Republicanism that people who are making excuses for Trump being more moderate than he was might have made 4 years ago, and he seems not to have budged very much.
Or, which is goes along with Nate is saying. I mean, I think one thing to think about, and I've been doing more reading about this, is whether we call it Trump's Republican Party. And on immigration policy, I would say it is Trump's Republican Party. On sort of race issues, maybe it is. On sort of like core fiscal questions,
yeah.
Is this Mitch McConnell's party? And has Mitch McConnell sort of won, you know, Trump campaign in 2016? Maybe you don't believe him anyway. Maybe we shouldn't have believed him. But the sort of infrastructure bill became like a joke after a while. Trump loves infrastructure spending, but it's not happening. And then it became obvious that Mitch McConnell was sort of yes him and then never let the bill move. So in some ways, like, this raises the question again of, like, is this Trump's Republican Party? And the answer to that is sometimes.
It's interesting because it's the more academic or economic parts of politics that have remained more traditional, you know. And that's, you know, those aren't Trump's strengths at all or Trump's interests.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like one of Trump's strengths in 2016 was jettisoning some of the least popular policies of the Republican Party, which were things like privatizing Social Security or, you know, cutting Medicare, Medicaid spending, things like that. But that part of the party clearly does still exist. You know, one thing that I was surprised about in preparing to have this conversation and looking at cases increasing in public opinion is that it seemed like there is some support or even majority support to shut down states again, to shut things down when cases are on the rise. One poll, 57% of Americans support reclosing state economies where there are outbreaks. Another poll said 65%. Is that surprising? And, you know, we've been talking about how public opinion is going to interact with policies in this case. Do we actually expect states to close again?
I mean, no, I don't expect states to close again. Okay, if you have a Republican governor, I just think that's not going to happen because I think the Republicans are done with state closures. I think that's just whether the Republican voters feel that way, definitely the Republican elites feel that way. But even if you're in a Democratic state, I think the way this happened is that like when you close a state the way that these states were closed, you lose so much revenue that you really can't afford to do that. Here in Kentucky, I think the governor here sort of moved, he's a Democrat, sort of moved on these issues. Once you see that your revenues are going down by so much, and the feds have been very reluctant, Mitch McConnell and Trump are reluctant to bail out states, I don't think it's realistic for really any state to have this kind of shutdown unless there's some broader shift in our politics that I don't see happening. I do think you'll see things like mask requirements. You're seeing that already where like red state governors who were nervous about like mask requirements are sort of like either supporting them or at least letting cities do them. Will you see a big push for social distancing? Will you see maybe Donald Trump may wear a mask? You know, will you see schools not open in some places? I think the answer to those questions are yes, but will we have that kind of every store is closed again thing? I doubt it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I doubt it.
You know, Nate, you said something so basic yet so such a good reminder for me at the beginning, which was lockdowns were initially supposed to be this emergency measure that was only supposed to happen for a couple of months. I mean, in the ideal world, what would we be doing in, you know, July? Would it be, okay, you'd better be wearing all your masks inside and yeah, malls aren't open? Or I mean, like, I'm kind of curious, like what is the ideal?
I think we're all figuring it out as we go along. You know, I think it's worth noting that, like, there are not very many countries anywhere in the world where there are still in lockdowns. There are countries where they've managed to find, like in Asia and parts of Europe, some other ways to solve it. There are countries where they've given up. I think people don't realize that, like, basically a large number of South American countries, India, Iran, Russia, South Africa, Pakistan, are all countries where Mexico, where cases are rising and lockdowns are being relaxed. So it's not just the U.S. It's like people seem not to be able to tolerate this for that much longer. Look, I do think like part of the problem is there's not more creative solutions. Like one thing that could really help, I think personally, in Texas, Arizona, Florida, whatnot, would be a strict 3 to 4 week lockdown, right? 3 to 4 weeks, we go back to phase zero, right? We really ask you all to respect this and also not violate it by socializing on your own, which is a big problem, right? You can close restaurants and go to one another's homes to eat dinner. You know, that might help. The original Imperial College paper back in March kind of said maybe we should have rolling periods where we go between lockdowns and open until we get a vaccine off and on. You know, I don't know, right? But I think Florida and Arizona and Texas have shown some willingness to close some things when cases are spiking, right?
Like bars and indoor dining bars and things like that to some extent.
Yeah. I have always thought kind of implicitly people are trying to manage this to a plateau. If you have a plateau, then you don't get the scary headlines. It just kind of becomes maybe after some period of time background noise. And so, I mean, look, that's what I think. If you had to kind of predict what would happen, I think that's what will happen is that people will kind of try to calibrate around a plateau. And a plateau is still pretty bad if a lot of people, like in Florida, something like 60,000 people got COVID last week officially. However, we're probably only capturing somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 5 cases. Some people might say 1 in 10. I think we're probably doing a little bit of a better job now, but there are probably 300,000 people in Florida who got COVID last week. Over a month, That's like
1,200,000.
1.2 million, right? I mean, so it's going through the population really fast.
All right. So, of course, we will see what ends up happening with all of this as we've been tracking for the past several months. But let's move on and talk about the role that conversations about race are playing in the 2020 election compared with 2016.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt
the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
In the wake of the 2016 election, there was some debate within the Democratic Party about the degree to which Hillary Clinton talked about race, minorities, and quote-unquote identity politics. Many said that she should have talked more about the economy. Meanwhile, it appeared that Trump's appeals to white identity worked to get him across the finish line. So both of those experiences suggested that maybe Democrats should talk less about identity issues. But if that was the post-2016 wisdom, for some, Biden isn't really embracing it. He's talking plenty about race and so far seems to be doing fine. And Perry, you recently wrote about this for the website in an article called How Biden is Winning an Identity Politics Election So Far. So I encourage people to go check that out. But just to start off, Perry, how would you describe the post-2016 conversation within the Democratic Party?
There was one group of people, often white, who said, hey, Democrats are talking about race too much. There was this very famous piece in the New York Times, I guess called The End of Identity Liberalism, that went pretty viral at the time. And the basic idea was that Hillary talked about individual groups too much and didn't talk about a collective identity enough. And that was like a big shortcoming for her. There was another group of people, many of whom were black, who sort of, like, I think Jamelle Bouie being sort of one of the more prominent ones, who sort of argued that the real thing was not that Hillary talked about race too much, but that Trump talked about race really well, and that he sort of like appealed to white identity in a particular way. Those things are not necessarily contradictory, by the way, but you had a lot of people, I think Tom Vilsack, Bernie Sanders, were quoted. I think Bernie Sanders said something after the 2016, like, we can't just go around saying, I'm a woman, vote for me. I don't actually think Hillary said anything like that, and I thought the comment was kind of annoying, but I think that's kind of what you were capturing, is like, was the Democratic Party leaning too much into these identity issues? So that's kind of reverberated the last 2 or 3 years, and we can discuss, like, I think it's hard to sort of measure how much did Hillary talk about identity, how much has Biden talked about identity, how much did Trump, and so on. So it's a little bit of a complicated subject. But I think Claire wrote a piece a few weeks ago that was sort of raising this question of, you know, now that we're in this sort of law and order discussion post-protest, will that help Trump? And the answer, according to the data, is no. When the George Floyd protest started, Trump was down to Biden by 6. Trump is now down by 10. A lot of things have happened, COVID being the most important, but I do think it's fairly clear that the, you know, the Confederate monuments, Confederate defense, you know, defending the flag, the sort of what Trump is doing on racial issues right now is not working. I think that's fairly clear. We can talk about why that might be, but that's what I was mainly trying to get at, is that we're having an election where it's like race and identity at the center of things, and Trump is not doing well right now.
Yeah, I think what was interesting about the post-2016 discussion is that the broad takeaway for most people in it was there was too much identity politics by the Democratic Party. But really what people were talking about was like the specific appeal to people in certain states, right? These like swing demographics in swing states, these Obama voters, these like white Obama voters that the Democrats lost, and what appealed to them and what didn't appeal to them. Frankly, like that's what the entire debate kind of boiled down to. And like Bernie Sanders was kind of saying, if you talk about economics, you win those people. A lot of it had to do with people voted against Clinton, right? That was obviously a huge factor in the election. But I do think a lot of the conversation after 2016 was, the Democratic conversation was like that you couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time, that it was sort of like, well, we got to appeal to these white voters that we lost. And I think Biden is in an easier position as a white man, in part because of his own identity politics, right? He can talk about race in a way that I think would be more divisive if it came from, say, a Kamala Harris as the Democratic nominee, that people would say, well, she's being divisive on race rather than being a countrywide uniter. The message matters, obviously, but the messenger matters as well.
So I think there are two pieces to this question, which is, one, did Trump's appeals to white identity work in 2016? And are those same exact appeals or very similar ones just not working in 2020? And then the other half of the question is Hillary Clinton's appeals to liberal identities or minorities versus how Biden talks about identity. Is that different? Is it more successful? So maybe let's key in on Trump for a minute. Is it fair to say that his appeals to white identity worked in 2016 to get him across the finish line?
Yeah, he's part of it.
I mean, he clearly gained ground among so-called white working class voters, and those voters were pretty decisive in the Midwest. You know, it's complicated though, right? I do kind of wonder, because of this experience with Biden, who kind of says, takes a lot of the official Democratic establishment party line on stuff, not the super woke wing of the party, but, you know, probably says things that are pretty similar to Hillary Clinton on balance, right? Maybe says them, if anything, a bit more awkwardly, because he's Joe Biden, and seems to elicit a very different reaction. I mean, I don't know. I kind of wonder if maybe we'll look back on this election in the 2016 election in 20 years and say, you know what, between voters just not being ready for a woman president and the particular way that Hillary Clinton was kind of demonized for many years and her own shortcomings, right, that maybe it was just kind of a Hillary Clinton effect. I don't know.
Can I float something?
Yeah.
Okay. In 2016, if you want to put a finer point on it, Trump obviously, you know, ran on some racist campaign taglines and policies, but often they were against foreign nationals, right? So it was against, it was about like closing the border, or, you know, it was about immigration. And in 2020, his response to these protests has been very much about pointing the finger at Black Americans or allies of Black protesters and saying, these people are causing America to descend into chaos. And that is more traditionally processed by Americans as racist, right? Whereas in 2016, you could be like, well, I'm just an immigration hardliner. But Trump in 2020 is more explicitly playing into like longtime American racism and dynamics, and that it's maybe a touch different for people, particularly, let's say, like white voters who were maybe inclined to give Trump a chance. But then they see his response and they say, yikes, like, that feels kind of racist in the way like I process what racist means. Does that make sense?
All right. So I disagree with that fairly adamantly, but let me say it. I don't think Trump was, the code was not too hard to figure out in 2016.
Yeah.
But in that said, I do think people recognize the code more. Yes. I think that, you know, in some ways he played some, like, I don't have a clip of things he said that Black people recognize as being against Black people, but there were plenty of those in 2016. But that said, the piece that I wrote tried to get into the fact that I think the media covers how he talks about race much differently.
Yeah.
It uses terms like racist and racism and so on that it didn't use. Corporate America is doing this differently. Like when you're seeing companies say Black Lives Matter and so on, that was not happening in 2016. So on mm-hmm. some level, it's not just Trump versus Biden or the Democrats versus Republicans. It's like the elites, the military, like the head of the Joint Chiefs was saying, I want the Confederate bases to be renamed. So Trump is fighting corporate America, the media, elite America, and the Democrats on his racial views. And I think that makes it much harder to win that fight than a few years ago. It was like much more sort of, there's a liberal view and there's a conservative view. Now it feels like Trump is in an isolated position. And I also think people's views on racial issues, I would argue, have changed. I don't think these polls are fake. I think they may be overstated, but I do think the evidence that people like Black Lives Matter more, the evidence that they see racism more, I think Trump is facing much harder headwinds than before on his racial views.
I think it's a good point, Perry. And like, you know, I should say, like, this is not to say that Trump didn't say things that were racist in 2016 about Black Americans. But here's a question, like, and I think you make a good point, which is that the environment has changed. I think probably a broader swath of Americans are more tuned into the dog whistles. Like, we've definitely learned. And that's interesting. I mean, you and I have had off podcast discussions about like the way the media talks about race and racism. And actually this weekend, I I listened to the long form podcast, did this interview with Dean Baquet.
Dean Baquet is the editor of the New York Times, for anybody who doesn't know that already.
Yes, sorry. But he does kind of acknowledge this evolution of the New York Times and the way that they have talked about Trump. And connected to that was a little bit, and Perry, this brings up something that you and I were talking about. He talked a little bit about like the readership model now that the Times relies on. The New York Times has seen this surge of readership, and there is a certain amount of public feedback that is like, yes, good, thank you for calling him a racist, basically, for lack of a better way to put it. But it was interesting to hear, you know, what you just articulated, Dean Baquet basically like say has happened over 4 years.
I want to come back to something Nate said, and he's been writing about, he wrote about early on, which is, Nate said that the whole time, which is that we may have overread 2016 a little bit. Trump won this weird election where the FBI director announces he's investigating one of the candidates 10 days before the election. The map is kind of weird. It's hard to win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. Hillary was this very unpopular candidate for a lot of reasons that had nothing to do with how she talked about race. And so in some ways, one thing I tried to mention in the article is part of it is that people always take a lot of lessons from the last campaign. But if the last campaign is weirdly weird and kind of fluky, maybe part of it is like we shouldn't have taken any lessons from that at all, except one day in November, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and you had the Comey letter, you had the Electoral College and other stuff. And, you know, but I do think like I hadn't thought about this as much in the context of media coverage. But yeah, I mean, clearly one thing that's changed since I got into journalism, I guess, is it used to be, I think, that journalists were afraid of expressing positions that seemed like they were too liberal because of the stereotype, with some validity, by the way, in the research of like journalism being a liberal field, right? Now it's kind of like there is now pressure from the left where journalists may feel pressure if they say things that they think are too centrist or too right-wing, certainly. And so maybe there are a few swing voters who are kind of in that kind of broad mainstream media tent. And the fact that now it's like, so number one, Trump is not very good at saying, at keeping the quiet part quiet, right? He's not very subtle. And if you ask people, a majority of voters actually say in most polls that they think Trump is a racist, which considering that most people don't like to call other people racist, even if they kind of think that deep down, it's kind of amazing that a majority of voters are willing to say the president is a racist before these whole protests, by the way, right? This was a year ago or something. So yeah, and I kind of think there's something about like the fact that like everything else is kind of going badly in the country just kind of makes it more naked.
Well, right, that's one question I have here is, are we saying that people have evolved, that voters have changed their views, that the media has become more willing to call a spade in the case of Trump's remarks, but that what's really happening is that he's completely botched coronavirus and people just don't like him because things are going poorly in the country, and so now don't care if it's criticizing him for coronavirus or criticizing him for how he deals with race, they're just more fine with criticizing him.
I think all these things can be true at once, and I think that they are, and sort of trying to grade out which one. I think Trump was regarded as an ineffective president before this, and now he's more unpopular. So everything Trump does is unpopular. I would argue that if Biden is ahead by 10 points, maybe Kamala is ahead by 5 or 6, you know, there's a case that Trump is just unpopular and a bad president, and people feel that way. I do think there's a case that elite views are shaping people and moving people, like the media, like corporations. I do think there's a case that views themselves are changing. And I think those three things are probably reinforcing each other, and so it'll be hard for us to I got an email after my story from this pastor who lives in southeast Pennsylvania. He don't mean to give his name, but he said he's a centrist person who doesn't like Trump, but has voted Republican before. He said his congregation is full of people who support Trump and full of Republicans, and he's been nervous to sort of ever say anything that might be perceived as negative about Trump. But he said what really changed for him was once NASCAR banned the Confederate flag, and once the NFL started defending kneeling, and once other things have happened in our politics these last 6 weeks, it's been easier for him to sort of speak about racial inequality inequality and issues that he was sort of nervous about before. And therefore, in some ways, you have this pastor sees what's happening in the outside culture, brings that into the church, and maybe that might change a person in the church's views too. So again, all these things are sort of swimming in the same pool. I do think a big part of the pool, though, is Joe Biden is hard to sort of cast as Mr. Woke because he's old, because he's moderate, because he's white, because he's not Barack Obama, because he's not Hillary Clinton, because he's, you know, it's just like the world has changed. And I do think part of where he's a hard target to hit as symbolizing how America is changing too much.
Yeah, that is kind of the other part of the equation that I wanted to key in on, which is, well, one, yes, in terms of Biden's own identity, it's very different from Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. But what about the way that he talks about these issues? Is it different?
So the thing that's interesting about Biden is, like, he does feel comfortable in, I would say, like, Black establishment communities and groups. You know, he was Barack Obama's vice president, right? Like, all that stuff. And so, but he obviously talks differently about race than Obama because he's not a Black man. But he does sometimes have this, like, presumptive way of talking about race that I think to younger Americans in general, Black and white, comes off as kind of, like, cringy. But to middle-aged to older people, they're just kind of like, yeah, that's the way everyone who's older talks. It's fine. And I think that in some ways, Biden is, yeah, a bit presumptive, sometimes overly presumptive, right? I go back to that, like, Charlemagne the God interview where he said, what was the quote? If you vote for Trump, you ain't Black. I mean, that stuff makes people cringe. But on the other hand, no one's in danger of saying Joe Biden is going to be a racially radical candidate who will alienate white America by running on, like, a reparations-only platform or something.
So, as a white person, I think there are a lot of white people, especially white people on the center or the left, who would love to say, I think racism is a problem and it's about time the country thought more about it, but I don't want to feel challenged or uncomfortable more than I'm ready for in my personal views, right? And there may be something about Biden's kind of awkwardness and just his age, right? He's kind of not using intersectionality or terms like that, right? Where people are like, this is addressing racism on terms that I, as a white person, or maybe an older Hispanic or Black person too, right? I don't know, but don't feel confronted by. Because there is some evidence that when kind of you use language that is more modern or whatever, and more challenging, that actually can persuade people to the left on the issue itself, but can also create negative feelings toward that politician for making them uncomfortable. And maybe Biden doesn't do that as much.
To be specific, I think there's two things I wanted to say was that Biden has not given the comment like I think Obama said something to the effect of certain people cling to their guns and their religion, which was sort of interpreted and probably did mean sort of white rural people.
Yeah.
Clinton had that famous deplorables comment. Biden has not made any comments like that. He has made comments. He uses the term systemic racism. He has talked about, you know, white America needs to recognize its, you know, its advantages in some ways. He's not used the term white privilege. So he's used terms like that. He's talked about race in a sort of a broader context in a similar way, but he hasn't used sort of these fraught things, so he's been more careful. And also, people hear what you say differently depending on who you are, because I think Barack Obama, when he said someone should not be arrested at their house, was not saying a radical thing, but it was sort of heard in a different way, I think, because he's Black. So I think that those is a factor as well. I would say, though, in the Biden while not speaking identity, I promise Barack Obama could not have promised to name a Black woman of the Supreme Court and a woman as the Democratic nominee of vice president. So Biden has made these two explicit promises on race, on identity, a woman VP, a Black female Supreme Court justice that I think no woman or minority candidate can make. And I would argue there can be no more identity politics than specifically naming jobs for gender and race on our gender and race basis.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, right? I think if you had told me, at least at the start of the campaign, that Biden would make those promises, I would have thought that there'd be more hot takes about them from conservatives.
And even some centrists, I would have thought. Yeah.
Are we taking this to mean that Biden has gone beyond where Obama or Clinton ever went in certain respects, but in other respects, like the way he speaks, appears more moderate, quote unquote, on identity, but that it has a lot to do with his own identity?
Yeah, I mean, the party's gotten more liberal. And if Biden is like a pretty establishment liberal, he's gone with the party. You know, if he's engaging with like police reforms, that's further than Obama or Clinton went. I mean, Obama certainly, I think, couldn't have engaged on police reform in that same way. A lot of people got very angry or were frustrated with his response to Ferguson in particular, right? So like, I think Biden can kind of say things more explicitly than certainly Obama could in this particular moment.
All right. Well, anyone else want to say anything before we wrap up here?
The question is, in some ways, what's the difference between 2016 and 2020? And I don't think I think it's a really hard question, but I think I just come back to the difference being Trump is the president now. He's not a candidate. It's not theoretical. And he has been somewhat bad at being the president. And that might be the sort of driving factor, particularly in terms of, and we should note that the coronavirus has had a particular effect on Black and Hispanic people, a disproportionate effect. So that also is playing a role in the sense that, you know, Kanye had the famous quote about George Bush not caring about Black people. But I'm sure if we polled people and asked them, do you think Donald Trump cares about Black people, that number would not be very high. So I think that gets to the question of, like, it's hard to disentangle this discussion about politics from the particularities of Trump and his unpopularity.
All right. Well, that's it for now. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
And before we go, I wanted to give a shout out to 538's coronavirus podcast. It's called Podcast 19. Last week, Anna Rothschild, the host, spoke with Anthony Fauci about the state of the pandemic in America, and he was pretty blunt. So I encourage everyone to go check out that interview wherever they get their podcasts. Again, that's Podcast-19, wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.